brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Tony Parker was down in Houston, and we just never connected. And I walk up to him and I say, "Hey, Tony, Dave Hicks, and I'm one of the inductees." He looks at me and he smiles. He goes, "Dave, I know who you are." And I said, "All right." I said, "I feel badly because I didn't get a chance to talk to you then in Houston. But every time I looked around, you were busy and I didn't want to interrupt." And so we had a great sort of 5, 8, 10 minute conversation with just the two of us. And just what a wonderful guy and so welcoming to someone like me.
David Hickson, Amherst College longtime men's basketball coach who retired in 2020, was inducted into the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame on August 12, 2023. Hickson coached at Amherst for 42 years, winning 2 national championships and twice being named the Division III Coach of the Year. He compiled a coaching record of 826 and 293, ranking him 15th in NCAA men's basketball when he retired in April of 2020. His winning percentage of 738 was good for 10th place in NCAA Division III history at the time of his retirement. During Hickson's tenure, Amherst participated in the NCAA National Tournament 20 times and compiled a 43-20 postseason record. Hickson is the first Division III coach to earn enshrinement into the Basketball Hall of Fame. He was elected to the New England Basketball Hall of Fame in 2003. Hey Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Roshan Russell, head boys basketball coach at St. Rita High School in Chicago, Illinois, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Take some notes as you listen to this episode with David Hickson, Basketball Hall of Famer and longtime head men's basketball coach at Amherst College. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel this morning, but I am pleased to be joined by Basketball Hall of Famer, longtime head men's basketball coach at Amherst College, David Hickson. Dave, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Great to be here, Mike.
Thrilled to have you on, especially in light of what you just were able to experience here at the Basketball Hall of Fame, your induction ceremony. The whole entire Hall of Fame weekend. Can you in any way, shape, or form sum up what that experience was like in a 30-second soundbite? We're going to dive into it a lot deeper, but just overall, your feelings from that weekend, what you took away from it, just for a sort of big picture before we dive into the details.
Yeah, you know, it's really hard to put into words, and I tried with the speech that I gave. The 3 days that I was there were truly amazing, and you know, my heroes, the big guys, I tell you, they were the best. They welcomed me in like I was one of them. I guess I am now, but, you know, you always feel like, geez, Division III versus NBA and all the other stuff, but they were great and met some, I think, some lifelong friends now that I never would have met before. And it's just terrific.
How does the process start? When's the first time that you get wind of, hey, I may be under consideration for this particular honor? How far in advance does this stuff start happening?
So I think it was like December 18th, or right in that area, they announced the people who have been nominated. And I was nominated last year, and I took great pride in that. I there was a poster of me and Manu Ginobili, and I took pictures of it and sent it to my guys, just sort of saying like, wow, how is this, right? And so it was really exciting. There's been a couple other Division III guys in the past nominated before, but then you got to get out of that stage. And so there were 37 people, some really famous names, by the way, nominated. And the American committee, the North American committee, it's called, which is 9 voting members, decide whether they want to push you on or not. And they pushed on 8 of us. And so I became a finalist on February 18th, which was announced at the NBA All-Star Weekend. And then we had to wait 5 weeks till April 1st to find out if we were in fact in. And that was by phone call. Sort of a pretty nerve-wracking 5 weeks, I'll tell you. But so it goes from nomination to finalist to call telling you whether you're in or out.
And that call came from Jerry Colangelo, correct?
It did. And it, you know, you really have no hint at all. And I kept looking at the numbers and saying, hey, you know, there's 8 of us here. That's big class. And I know there's 5 guys going in for sure, and try to figure out the rest. And so it was a nerve-wracking time.
Who's the first person you call after you get the news that you're getting in?
Well, I'm gonna tell you this, even though now it's over, I can tell you this. We called both of our boys, and you know, they told us we couldn't tell anybody because it was going to be properly unveiled. And basically, they sequestered us for a week. That next weekend at the NCAA Division Final Four, it was going to be announced on TV, ESPN, nationally, and we weren't supposed to tell anybody, but you know how that goes. We tell our kids and say, but don't tell anybody. I'd like to know who they told and who they told and who they
Absolutely.
Told.
That's good stuff. That is funny. All right. So let's get to the weekend itself. The itinerary, you fly into Springfield, you get in there, and what's it like? What's the experience? Just walk us through kind of what happens at each step of the way.
Right. And so here's the unbelievable thing. My house is 29 miles from the Hall of Fame. So I don't fly.
Nice. You're driving.
I was driving. And so we had to go to Mohegan Sun, which is about an hour and 20 minutes for the first part of the adventure. And that was on Thursday morning. But I had a media request at the Hall of Fame by a local reporter. And so I drove early to the Hall of Fame. Right in front of the Naismith statue, did a TV interview, jumped back in my car, drove to Mohegan Sun. I got to Mohegan Sun and, you know, right away, the first thing I had was a chance to practice my speech on a teleprompter, which I've only done one time before. I'm a storyteller. I love to talk, but it's all, you know, impromptu, sort of like telling stories and the reading. I thought, boy, this may be a problem. And so went down, practiced it 3 or 4 times, went from there to an autograph session, went from there to some interviews. And that so Thursday basically got covered with that. The interesting thing for me is, you know, because I'm not a real household name, is I would walk through the corridors of Mohegan Sun and get absolutely mobbed by autograph seekers, which that, you know, I have never experienced that before. And that was crazy. It was really, it was crazy. And I don't know how to handle it, right? Just, I signed them all. And so then we go from there. We get up Friday morning. And Friday morning, we go through, we sort of all have breakfast together. And then we go through another autograph session. We go through some more interviews. And those were really cool. I think they were on NBA TV. And then we go to Thursday, that we're on Friday night. Now, Friday night, was the whole ring ceremony. And so we sort of get together with a small VIP reception, spill over into the larger reception, and then go in and get our jacket and our ring. And then went out with a bunch of guys after and, you know, my guys, which was wonderful. My part of my basketball family. And then we get up for the big day on Saturday. You know, we get a chance one last time to do a run through our speech. And, you know, then it's sort of celebrity meet and greet and a big party and all that stuff. And bang, we're on. And so, and then naturally after we had a big party, again, my basketball family, and it was just wonderful, wonderful weekend.
Did you have a quiet moment to get an opportunity to talk to any of the other inductees, any moment that sticks out with any of them?
Yeah, well, you know, it's really funny because, you know, I had met everybody except three down at the when we were introduced on the Final Four weekend, and I hadn't talked to Becky Hammon, and I got a chance to spend a good 10-minute conversation with her, which was terrific. I hadn't met Pop, and you know, sort of we'd been around each other a bit, but we hadn't really sat down and talked, and I had a chance to do that a bit. And some of our commonalities and people that we both knew, and Tony Parker. So interesting. Tony Parker was down in Houston and we just never connected. And, you know, I walk up to him and I say, "Hey, Tony, you know, Dave Hickson, I'm one of the inductees." He looks at me and he smiles. He goes, "Dave, I know who you are." And I said, "All right." I said, "You know, I feel badly because I didn't get a chance to talk to you down in Houston. But every time I looked around, you know, you were busy and I didn't want to interrupt." And so we had a great sort of 5, 8, 10 minute conversation with just the two of us. And, you know, just what a wonderful guy and so welcoming to someone like me.
You mentioned earlier that you had your basketball family around you. What were some of those conversations? What were the sentiments of guys who had played for you, guys who know you, people that had been a part of your circle? Is there any moment, comment, thing that really hit you that is going to stick with you for the rest of your life that somebody said over the course of this whole process?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of hard to sort through and pick out one because the sentiments were just, as you can imagine, phenomenal. The fact that people would travel as far as California to come in for the weekend for me, for us, really, not for me, because like I said in my speech, you know, everybody had a piece of the night. In other words, if that player or that player or that player aren't there, maybe we don't win this or win that. We don't achieve this. We don't achieve that. And so, you know, it's your numbers and your resume. My guess is that it gets you into the Hall of Fame but not the most important thing. I mean, the problem is there's a lot of Hall of Fame coaches out there who will never get in the Hall of Fame, who have been great mentors, and have great relationships with former players. And so, just the overall sentiment, you know, we had a chance, the Amherst president, came down and attended all the festivities, which was wonderful to see. And, you know, Amherst is a really academic school and we haven't always had that sort of support, from our administration. And, so it was wonderful to see him come down and the kind words that he said, I think left all of my guys sort of thinking like, wow, that was really cool. Great to have an Amherst president involved. Great to see that the school appreciates this achievement, but as far as one particular thing, there were just so many great sentiments. I mean, I had tears in my eyes the whole time. It was so wonderful.
When you think about, and this is one of the things that when we interviewed your former player, Matt Goldsmith, he talked about just your ability to build relationships and how important that was to him, but also to anybody who is an alum of the program. And then you think about the people that came out and supported you over the course of this weekend. And as you said, ultimately what people are looking at when they see David Hickson Hall of Fame, it's going to be, here's his record. Here's the national championships he won. Here's all these accomplishments that are down on paper. But I'm guessing based on just the brief time that we've had to interact and my conversation with Matt, that those relationships that you built over time, that ultimately that really is what's most important to you. So talk a little bit about why those relationships were so important to you, and then maybe what you did that enabled you to build the kind of relationships that are going to have people flying in from California to support you in this great moment.
Yeah. And I think, you know, again, I think life is about relationships. It really is. And, you know, you could throw all the other stuff out in the end, but it's about relationships. And, you know, to this day, I get calls from my alums, whether it's, you know, they're changing jobs and they want me to connect them with somebody. Either their kids are looking at jobs and they want to, or colleges and they want to get connected. Maybe somebody has a young basketball player and they need advice on where to go. And it's they have remained such a big part of my life. And that again, is more meaningful to me than all the other stuff. And, you know, when I first started at Amherst, a lot of people don't know this. I mean, I coached my first 10 years I coached. I also coached track and field as an assistant in the springtime. But more importantly, I coached 23 years of soccer. And four of those were one as a head coach with the women and three as an assistant with the women. And, you know, I get notes from all those people and not all those people, but so many of those people. And, you know, my very first team that I coached at Amherst was freshman to be the head coach of was freshman soccer. And I had never played soccer. I went to a few camps and my boss, thank God, my AD and the head soccer coach was Peter Gooding, who was at the time one of the preeminent soccer coaches in the United States. He was a Brit. And so I went in well equipped, I thought, to coach soccer. But to this day, those kids refer to themselves as the youngsters. And, you know, I hear from them as much as I hear from anybody. And so, but relationships, it's about just taking the time. I mean, it really is just about taking the time. I mean, you know, one of the people that I look up to, John Calipari, I had John as my presenter. One of my presenters was Jim Calhoun, but John might be the busiest guy in America. I mean, you know, he's got something going every minute. You know, I look at his Facebook, he's flying here, flying there, seeing this kid, seeing that kid, seeing a parent, blah, 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 doing this and all this other stuff. Plus he's coaching Kentucky. And, but he always has time. You know, he always has time. And so, you know, as I grew up, I always thought that was important, but I've always made sure I have time. And I used to amaze my assistants. And Matt usually tells the story, Matt Goldsmith, where we were X and an O in the heck out of something. And we'd been going on for an hour or something like that. And an alum just stuck his head in the door, one of my soccer alums actually, and said, hey, coach, hey, won't bother. Just want to say hi. I said to the guys, put this on hold. And I went for a walk and talked about his kid and showed him around the school a little bit. An hour later, I come back to the basketball piece. And, you know, that meant so much to that alum and his son. But it also meant as much to me. I mean, and so I do think relationships are the number one most important thing. People, and strangely enough, let's go to wins and losses. People play for you. They'll play harder for you, the stronger the relationship that you have. They believe you. They trust you. There's so many pieces that go into building a great relationship with people.
It's really well said. And I think it's a lesson and a theme that if I could put a top three in terms of things that coaches have said to us on the podcast over the years of what is important to them. And ultimately it comes down to relationships is right there at the top, both in terms of relationships with their players, but relationships with other coaches that then enable you to be able to move on and move up in your career. And I think that Matt did tell us that same exact story. And he said, he added in there that at some point he said, coach, come on, man, we got to get prepared. Like, what are we doing? We can't be taking an hour out of our time here to go and, you know, prepare for this next tournament game. We got to be ready. And so he added that little detail, but it is, I think, telling when you start talking about how do you build relationships, and you can try to figure out all kinds of little tips and tricks and whatever. But I think you said it best when you just said it's time, right? It's, you have to carve out the time. You have to set aside other things that might be important, but they're not as important as the people in front of you. And I think that ultimately, if you can put the people that are in front of you at the forefront, you're going to end up with a much better relationship because people, as you said, they're going to know that you care about them. And that really is when it makes a difference, especially as a coach, when you're trying to talk about trying to get the most out of your players, both as basketball players on the floor, but also just as human beings and helping them in their life, which ultimately that's the goal, right? We're using basketball as a vehicle to be able to impact lives. And I think that's really what it boils down to. All right, one more Hall of Fame question, and then we'll kind of jump back and go through the scope of your life. Is there anything that stands out from the weekend that was surprising, like something that you didn't know was going to happen, or just you're like, ooh, that was kind of interesting, not what I expected? Is there anything kind of fits that particular description for you?
Well, I mean, a few things. I think, first of all, I think the sort of welcoming attitude of these guys who are genuine stars, and I put that in quotes because I the level of the stardom of, you know, Dwayne Wade, you know, is pretty amazing. And the fact that they treated me as an equal, was unbelievable. Matter of fact, you'll laugh at this. They're trying to get all these guys together, and you can imagine all these Hall of Famers and coaches and everything. The room is so noisy, and the guy that's trying to get them together from the Hall of Fame, so we can go out and be presented in front of, you know, this sort of party that they're having for us. And of course, no one's paying attention. The guy from the Hall of Fame, his voice is just about shot. And so he looked at me and sort of put his hands out like, hey, can you help me? So I did something I did when I was coaching all the time, because my players knew it. I put my fingers to my lips and gave a really shrill whistle, which always got my players' attention. The room went quiet, like in a heartbeat, like not even one murmur. It just like, boom. And I felt like, wow, that's
still got it. Still got it.
Yeah. And with these guys too, because I'm telling you what, getting these guys corralled sometimes is you know, not that easy a task. So that was like almost startling to me, the result of my whistling. So not that that has a whole lot to do with anything, but that was a moment that really shocked me. And then, you know, I got a chance to talk to people like Mike Wilbon and relate some commonalities that we had and people that we both knew. And, you know, Paige Steele, who was always one of my favorites on ESPN. So it was truly amazing to meet people that I never really thought I would meet and tell them what I thought of them and compare different, you know, again, commonalities and things like that.
Yeah, it's very cool. I mean, the opportunity again to sort of rub elbows in that crowd and be able to see people that you may have previously seen on TV or whatever it may be. And as you said, I think what you realize when you get a chance to talk to people is that we all have way more in common probably than what we oftentimes realize. I think that's one of the things that I've experienced that to some degree with the podcast, that there's been numerous people that in a normal setting, I would never have an opportunity to be able to interact with. And just because of the platform here, being able to have conversations and learn from and develop relationships with people that I never thought that that would be possible. And just as you're describing, the opportunity to interact and have a common bond with a fellow human being who, again, has a completely different experience, as you said, walking down the hallway and having a ton of people asking you for your autograph, right? It gives you a little window into, hey, what's it like for these guys who are players or coaches in the NBA that everywhere they go, they're recognized and somebody wants a piece of their time. And it gives you a little bit more of appreciation of kind of what they go through. And you kind of get to see them again as a human being, as opposed to just a face or a body on TV. And I think that's one of the things that, again, we've enjoyed with the podcast is getting a chance to know people and have an in-depth conversation with somebody for an hour, hour and a half, that you just don't get to do that very often with very many people. And to your point, to be able to do that on this special weekend for you and for them in a lot of cases, is just, I mean, again, the opportunity I'm sure is one that is going to stick with you and the people that were there supporting you for the rest of your lives, obviously.
I'll tell you a quick story about the autograph thing. And so I'm walking down with my son and nobody's sort of coming over, which is great. And I said, keep going, keep going. And all of a sudden I said, coming in 12 o'clock. First guy came in. Next thing you know, we must have had, you know, 25 people there. And somebody in the crowd of people waiting to get an autograph go, look, there's Dwayne Wade. And I'm hoping that all 25 go, right? It's Dwayne Wade, right? Like only four people left.
Wow.
So
wow.
One of the guys in the crowd goes to me, he goes, coach, we're staying loyal to you. And I thought like, well, how cool is this, right? And I might even have that on film because I had a guy filming some stuff. And so the four people that went over and got Dwayne's autograph come back. And as I'm signing autographs, I looked up and I sort of quipped. I said, hey, any of you guys that left me to go see Dwayne Wade, you are not getting autographs. And of course, everybody loved that. And naturally, I signed all of them. But I was hoping all 25 would take off and go, but it didn't happen.
That's good stuff. It's so funny to me. You think, again, the fact that you could kind of joke around and be a part of that and have that experience. And I always think, man, what it would be like to just walk out and everywhere you go, have that be in the situation. Like everybody that you see in a public space recognizes you, wants to get a piece of you, wants to have an autograph with you. And I'm always amazed that the patience that celebrities, athletes, coaches in those situations, the again, the patience that you have to be able to put up with, you know, having people come and talk to you all the time like that. Again, in a one-off moment, you can see how nice that is. And then you think, man, if you had to do that every single day, what would that be like if that was what your day-to-day life was like? And you just think about how people perceive athletes, right? Where you only, a lot of times somebody, a little kid or family or whatever, they only get one chance to make an impression with that kid or that family. And obviously they can't sign everything and do everything. And so you think about that delicate balance that they have to walk between being accessible and yet also being able to continue to function in their life. It's kind of, they got to do quite a balancing act, I would say. Let's put it that way.
They do. And you know, it's funny. One of my favorite all-time players who I think may be the GOAT is Bill Russell. And, you know, Bill didn't give autographs. And so I played in a celebrity golf tournament that he was in. I wasn't in his foursome. But, you know, they have people who pay for each tee, and there's a sign on each tee recognizing that. And everybody signed the tee sign with their autograph sort of thing. And Bill would do it because he knew what they were doing. They were trying to get him to autograph something. And at the end, two of the guys in his group that he was playing with asked him to sign the cards because, right, as you know, you have to have people attest it. He wouldn't do it. And so imagine how that must be. Here you are, that you don't give autographs and people are on you all the time. So I went over and talked to him. And the first thing I had to say to disarm him a bit was, Bill, hey, listen, I'm not here for an autograph. I wanted to come over and talk to you about, you know, my childhood watching you play. And I eventually got his autograph, not that day, but for a different reason, which is another whole story I won't go into right now. But it must be really difficult, you know, if you're someone who doesn't give autographs, because people don't stop. They'll keep asking. And so for Bill Russell, it was even harder than it is most. It's easy to sign an autograph. It may take time, but you know, everybody's happy. But when you're saying no and people are still chasing you relentlessly. So anyway, it's interesting.
Yeah. It's got to get old fast. I mean, again, there's an element of, hey, it's cool that people are asking me for my autograph. And then eventually I'm sure that wears on you pretty quickly, that no matter where you go, somebody's asking for that. All right. Let's leave the Hall of Fame behind for a second. Let's go back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me a little bit about your first experiences with the game of basketball and what made you fall in love with the game.
Yeah. So my dad was a coach. I was born in New Hampshire. My first 7 years were in New Hampshire. And my dad, actually, they won a state championship at a very tiny school called Raymond High School. And then he went on to Plymouth High School. And then he moved to Andover High School in Massachusetts. You know, again, he was a guy that was always trying to make a better situation for his family. He had done a great job building the Plymouth program, and they would be one of the best in the States the next year. But he left to take a team that they went 0-18, his first year end of a high school, and he was brought in to rebuild it, which he did, in a spectacular fashion. But, you know, I would go and watch his practices, played hoop out in the yard since I can remember, always wanted to be a coach. So I'd draw up the plays for all the guys, and we had a little playbook. So we played, you know, we spent countless hours playing hoop and out in the driveway. And, you know, drawing up plays. I always wanted to be a coach. And so I drew up the plays for the local team and went down and played at the youth center on every Saturday morning, played in the church league group, like Tuesdays and Thursday night or something. So tried to play a lot, you know, made all the teams throughout my life, played for my dad. We won a state championship in the old Boston Garden in 1970, which is something I'll never forget. Sort of the home of my heroes, watching, you know, the Celtics of the late 60s with the Jones boys and Heinsohn and Russell, the whole group, Satch Sanders. I mean, it was an amazing experience to go and play on the court that they played on and win a state championship for my dad.
Yeah, absolutely. When you get an opportunity to move on and play college basketball, what do you remember about the decision to go to Amherst? Was that an easy decision? Were there other possibilities? What were you thinking about as you were heading into college?
Yeah, I did have some other possibilities. I had a Division II look, a Bentley College. I had my physics teacher wanted me to go to Brown. My football coach and history teacher wanted me to go to Dartmouth. my math teacher wanted me to go to Amherst. My best friend was going to Tufts. I applied and got accepted to all of those schools. And yeah, it really, truth be told, my dad, who was, you know, a no-nonsense guy, he said, well, where are you going to school? And I said, I don't know, Dad. He goes, well, I'm going out to a meeting. I'll be back in 2 hours. I want an answer. And so I sat there, and about 10 minutes before he came home, my mother comes out and goes, well, where are you going to go to school? All the financial aid was basically the same, except Bentley, which was more. And I said, I don't know, Mom. And she looked at me and she said, well, you know, I think if your father had his druthers, I think he'd have you go to Amherst. I pushed all the others away. I signed the Amherst papers. I said, done. My dad walked in and said, where are you going to school? I said, Amherst, Dad. And he goes, good choice. And that was, we didn't even tell that story to each other because I didn't want to, you know, give my mom up for telling me when it was supposed to be a secret until he was probably 88, 89 years old.
That's good stuff. That is good stuff. What?
And, you know, actually, I was recruited for track. I was a sprinter, and I was third in New England as a junior in the 200 meters. And then I was recruited for football and basketball. And then, but football, I got a really bad concussion in August of my going into my freshman year, and they told me I couldn't play. And it was really sad for me. But, you know, I totally fell in love with basketball even more so than I had before and thought, you know, I'm not interested in football, and just played basketball in college and ran track.
What was the adjustment like from high school to college? What do you remember about that transition?
Well, I think from the moment I stepped into the gym, you know, I loved it because the whole level of competition went up because now, you know, you might have been the best player on your high school team. But so was everybody else. And at a place like Amherst, it's not just Massachusetts, it's from all over the country. And, you know, so I had a good friend from Connecticut. I had a good friend from Illinois. I had a good friend from California that were all really good players. And so, the competition, like right away, pickup games, September 5th or whenever the first time we played together was, it was really cool to see that level of competition.
Obviously, Amherst, great academic school. You mentioned earlier that you kind of always wanted to be a coach. What was your thought process academically? Were you focused on, hey, I need to get my degree and I'm going to head into coaching? Were you thinking about something else just because of the opportunity that was there at Amherst? What was the thought process as you entered college?
Yeah, and that's always a tough choice. You know, I have kids who have played for me, and I can tell that they want to coach, but they're having a really hard time communicating that with their parents.
Yeah.
Because of the investment that these parents have made. And, you know, I don't think I ever told my parents that I wanted to coach until I was a senior. I was a mathematics and psychology major. And so, you know, I didn't know where I was going. There were a zillion different directions I could have gone, but, you know, I was lucky enough to get a fellowship presented to one senior, graduating senior, and spend an extra year at Amherst, you know, fully immersed in coaching. It was a fellowship called the Hitchcock Fellowship, paid for everything. It was a wonderful position, faculty position, actually. And for that 1 year, I thought to myself, no, this is what I want to do. And, you know, with kids who really have a passion for coaching, but their parents have this big investment, you know, I would just say to them in the end, I would say, hey, guys, listen, most important thing, parents want their kids to be happy. And, you know, they don't want to see you sitting in a lawyer's chair or in a big business building if you're not going to be happy. They want you to follow your passion. When it's all over and done and all said, they want you to follow their passion. And so trust me, if that's what you want to do, you should do it. And that's how I felt.
Makes sense. I mean, right. I think ultimately anybody who's a parent would agree with that sentiment that you want your kids ultimately to find something that they love and that they're passionate about so that it does translate into the kind of life that makes them happy. And we've all seen people who have, from the outside, at least theoretically, great jobs that are miserable. I'm sure you've known plenty of people in that position. and I have as well, that you think about the way they've got plenty of money. They got plenty of toys. They got plenty of things that from the outside, people would say, hey, this person has everything they could ever want. And yet they're not happy. And then you have other people that are, you know, that have followed their passion, whatever that profession may be. and those people have happiness. I think that's a really a great piece of advice for anyone when you're looking for a career. So during that year, as you're getting started with coaching, obviously you had had it in your mind for a long time. What was it as you really got into it? So for the first time now, your playing career is done. You're in the coaching profession. You're getting a taste of it. What did you love about it immediately? What was something that the piece of it that you took and you're like, yeah, this is it. I know for sure I'm in the right spot.
Yeah. I mean, I think, the competition, being on the other side now and seeing how hard kids are competing for positions, you know, whether they think they should be starting, you know, whatever the issues were, I could see this complex. And some people say, yeah, it's complex, but it's really very simple. But it's not all that simple when you're trying to figure out minutes, you're trying to figure out how to get someone better so they can get those minutes, how to juggle basically starting out with probably 16 or 18 kids, cutting two or three or four, and then trying to, you know, you got 200 minutes, you know, trying to figure out who gets those minutes, who starts, who doesn't start. And there was this level of competition even prior to games. But then the preparation, you know, I was fortunate. I played for an older fellow, Rick Wilson, who in his prime, you know, was sort of an innovator in a lot of things in the game. And he loved to scout. And now he'd found a guy who could drive him around New England because, you know, he was 65 and he didn't like to drive through snowstorms. I'm 24. I'll drive through anything, right? I'm 22, right. 23 years old. Yeah. So we drove all around New England till all hours of the night to watch teams play. And then the preparation to sit in an office and try to figure out, like, okay, how do we beat this team? How do we get an edge on this team? Who do we need to play? Who do they guard? There's so many pieces to it. And I just found that really intriguing, putting the puzzle together.
Did you have as much passion? You talked about how at the beginning of your career, you're coaching some other sports as well. Did you have the same level of passion for those sports? Or was it clear basketball was the direction that you wanted to go? Was there ever a thought that you could go a different direction?
Yeah, no, there wasn't. No, it was basketball for sure. I did coach football for 2 years, but you know, football was a whole different animal for me and wasn't. And I think my wife actually told me if I was coaching football, she wouldn't have married me. But anyway, the, you know, track's different. It's a, you know, very individualistic thing. Although I did work with the relays and loved that. It's just different. It didn't encompass me like with the passion that basketball did. And then soccer was really interesting. I mean, soccer, I got to really love soccer. I got, you know, I was up watching the Women's World Cup semifinal at, 6 o'clock in the morning in the final and the USA team, and doesn't make any difference, you know, men, women, whatever it is. I mean, I love the game of soccer and I was given that passion by my old boss. But, again, I think the thing about basketball for me, you play more games. It's in a smaller setting. And so you really feel like, you know, you can coach the whole thing. Whether it's in practice or game, because people are in a close proximity to you. I'll never forget my first day coaching the women's soccer team. You know, soccer is a big field, you know, 50 yards wide, and somebody on the far side of the field, I was trying to communicate to them that they had missed the rotation they were supposed to make in the back defensively, and everybody stopped. I said, "What's the matter?" And my assistant came over and said, who was a female, said, coach, don't yell at him. I said, I'm not yelling at him. I'm communicating with him. And so it was one of those moments because you had to yell. And I went over to the person and I just sort of said, hey, the only way you can hear me, but in basketball, it's a bit different. And the basketball people are right there, up close and personal the whole time. And so the intensity of it, you know, translated over into that passion, I think.
Tell me a little bit about the opportunity to become the head coach at Amherst. How does that opportunity come to you? And what do you remember about the process of you getting that job?
Yeah. So I wasn't going to apply for the job because I was, I was 24. I'd actually applied for a job the year before up at Deerfield Academy, a mathematics and coaching job. And the guy who was the mathematics teacher decided to stay. And then so he kept on with his coaching. And so I didn't get it. And, you know, who knows what would have happened if I'd gotten that, like the whole world would have changed for me. But anyway, my track coach said to me, you know, Dave, you throw your application in. I said, well, you know, I just feel like I don't have enough experience. And he said, no, we'll throw your name in anyway. Threw my name in, and they brought seven people, including me, into interview. And they were all more qualified on paper than I was, although they weren't Amherst grads and didn't know the Amherst team like I did. As far as being out and coaching basketball, they were older and more experienced. And so that was seven. And when I got into the final three, a little bit like making the finals, you know, for the Hall of Fame, all of a sudden, you know, when it's 37 people, yeah, you know, whatever. But when it gets to eight, now it's serious. Like, now don't mess with me right now. Now I feel like I'm in the hunt to get this thing, actually. And same thing with the job. It was when it was seven, I thought like, okay, thank you for the interview experience. That was wonderful. And then when I got to the final three, I said, no, guys, you've given me the experience before. This is the real deal. Now I'm competing, really competing for this job. And I feel like I should get it. And so I did. And, you know, it you know, again, it was a wonderful experience that started with my track coach telling me, hey, if nothing else, get the experience, apply for the job. And then ended up with a job, which, you know, was amazing to me. And so I'm 24 years old and I'm the head basketball coach at Amherst College.
How long was it into your tenure before you felt like you had a handle on who you were as a coach? Did you know right away, or did it take you a half a season or two before you really felt like, hey, I know who I am and what I am as a coach?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's really funny because it evolved and kept evolving. And I think if you talk to, you know, Matt or Kevin Hopkins, who's down at Muhlenberg, or Luke Flacherzi, who's out at Rochester, you know, they would all tell you that it kept evolving. And I think that's one of the great things. If you're a coach, you know, when I first started, everybody wanted to be Bobby Knight, you know, yep. And you can't be somebody that you're not. And then, as you know, of course, Bobby Knight, a lot of his things sort of fell out of favor. You know, people wanted to be this guy. People wanted to be that guy. And you have to be who you are. And, you know, the over under at least two, three, four, 5 years, whatever it was, till I really got my feet, you know, wet and starting to identify who I was. And like I say, it sort of kept evolving. And I always tell people, I think, you know, one of the big changes in my life that made me the biggest change, the one that made the sort of starkest change in how you related with people was when I got married and had kids. And it wasn't just basketball. When I was doing just basketball. I was so focused on just basketball and, or just soccer, whatever I was coaching at the time. And when all of a sudden it had to be spread, to a second family, or what would become my first family, my kids and my wife, it made me a better person. It made me a better coach, made me a better human being.
All right. So how did you, I think one of the things that we talk with coaches about a lot is trying to achieve, I guess the word is balance, but I'm not sure that always fits, but trying to be able to have time for your family, have time for your basketball family. And then you also had another challenge in that your wife was also a big time college coach. So you, not only are you balancing one coaching schedule with family, but you're balancing two coaching schedules with family. So just give me an idea of how you and your wife approach that in terms of making sure that both sides of that equation, both your family life at home and your respective sports at your job, got your everything. Because obviously, if we go back to the story that you shared at the beginning of, hey, I'm dropping everything to spend an hour with an alum. Well, that was at one point when it's just you. And as you said, it's just basketball and you're going full throttle. Even then, that can sometimes be a challenge. But now you're throwing in a whole nother set of people that have demands on your time. So just how did you put all that together? How did you guys work that puzzle?
Yeah, and it's a blur. But, you know, I give all of the credit to my wife who organized most of it. You know, we get up in the morning, get going. Kids would go to school, even before the kids went to school. You know, we weren't big fans of daycare. Sort of had a little bit of a rough experience with my oldest son. He was only in it for a few months. And so we thought, you know, they're better off with us. And so we'd have students from the colleges, you know, take care of them, but they'd usually either be in the gym or at the pool all the time. I always tell stories about, you know, my wife would go in one direction with one kid. I'd go in the other direction with another kid, and we'd sort of alternate and rotate them. And I think of my 5-year-old, you know, we'd win a game up at Williams, and on the way home, the guys had earned it and wanted to watch a movie. Well, I hate to think about what I didn't have enough hands to cover his eyes and both ears, you know, so he didn't get an early education. But yeah, it really was a bit of a blur. We really worked hard, and there were moments when, you know, the baton, you know, got dropped, so to speak. It wasn't dropped, but, you know, that somebody was 10 minutes late because they were finishing up with something that was really important with one of their, either with her diver or one of my players, before we could hand off, you know, the kids. But it was seamless in the end. It all worked out. And, you know, I'll tell you a favorite story here. So I had my son Matthew was probably a year and a half, I'm going to guess. And he gets dropped off, and we're preparing for Franklin and Marshall. It's the first time we go to the NCAAs. Like, they're number one in the country. Everybody's already crowned him. And so I'm trying to find something on film. And so, you know, we're watching this film, and my wife drops Matthew off, and all of a sudden, you know, it got stinky. And so I knew he had to be changed. His diaper had to be changed. So nice. Back in the days, you shared an office very often. And so the women's basketball coach, Sue Wacky, one of my all-time favorites and a great coach, she said, "Hey, you keep watching film. I'll change Matthew." I said, "Terrific." Now, she didn't have kids, and so this was, you know, I'm thinking, okay, go ahead. So she goes to change kids. Well, she's got a game that night, and so she's dressed in the, you know, nice black sweater, black slacks, and she, you know, takes the diaper off and lifted his legs to wipe him. And I'm going to get a little too graphic here. And I got to tell you, there was an explosion that took place. I turned around and looked. She was covered in this yellow whatever it was.
Nice.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Awful. And but I have to tell you, everybody in the room, my two assistants, myself, and Sue, dropped to our knees and probably cried with laughter for 5 minutes before we could all right the ship. It was absolutely unbelievable. So, but those were the adventures that would happen only because, you know, we're always running around. We're always running around, you know, trying to figure out, well, okay, keeping one eye over here, one eye over there to make sure the kids were safe. And again, you know, my wife, Mandy, did such a great job, either getting, another athlete, and the college girls, they love to take care of our kids. And so, you know, whether they were in the gym or in the pool, sort of playing with the kids, it was terrific. And lucky to be at a place like Amherst, which allowed us to do that.
Hey, Hoopheads Nation, whether you're a beginner basketball player looking for a place to start or a seasoned vet looking to level up your skills, I want to tell you about your new go-to secret weapon. It's called Train. Train is a basketball training and education platform that gives you on-demand access to premium basketball courses created by expert coaches and trainers from around the world. Want to get better at blowing by your defender? Learn setup drills with NBA and international pro trainer Marius Williams, or how to use the punch drag with NBA trainer Kerry Darting. Looking to level up your catch-and-shoot skills? Practice space shooting workouts with former lead female trainer for Kobe Bryant's Mamba League, San Dixon. Or if you're just starting out, learn the basics of shooting and finishing at the basket from international champion, 3-time Romanian Player of the Year, and Train co-founder Vlad Moldovanu. Train has 32 and counting actionable, expert-led, on-demand basketball training courses that teach you exactly how to improve your ball handling, shooting, attacking, and more. For a limited time, Hoopheads listeners get 35% off monthly, annual, and lifetime plans. Just go to gotrainbasketball.com/hoopheads to learn more and sign up for a free 7-day trial. All right. So to piggyback on that last point right there, let me ask you this kind of a two-part question. When you think about, first of all, what makes Amherst so special? And obviously you spent the vast majority of your life associated with Amherst, but then to take it one step further, just what do you love about Division III basketball? Because obviously a guy with your success at some point, I'm sure you had people reach out to you about moving up to a higher level. whether it was Division II or Division I. I'm sure you had some opportunities along the way. So just what made it so special at Amherst, and what do you love about Division III basketball? You can combine those into whatever kind of answer you want to throw out there at us.
Yeah, and that answer could take us, you know, three podcasts, because it's as the game has changed, you know, even that equation has changed with, you know, the one and done, and more importantly, the transfer portal, which all of a sudden makes Division III potentially being a one and done, or two and done, whichever it is, before you develop them enough that they're good enough and someone in the Ivy League or, the Patriot League, you know, or scholarship place wants to offer them. But, you know, from the get-go, it was this unbelievable balance. I was brought up, you know, by, again, this athletic director, Peter Gooding, who was a Brit, and he used to talk all the time about the place of athletics in the academy. The place of athletics, not the place of the academy around an athletic program, but the other way around, student athlete, not athlete student. And that was really special to me. I mean, having gone through, I thought that when I came out of Amherst as a student, I was a critical thinker that I hadn't been to that level when I went in. And it was not easy. A lot of late nights, a lot of tough tests, a lot of disappointments as a student. But I came out a much, much more intelligent person, whatever that means. I'm not saying a smarter person, more intelligent. I would critically think. I think that helped my coaching as we went on. So I believed in what Amherst stood for and still stands for today, a really true balance between the academic side and the athletic side. And then I think, you know, I really enjoyed early on, and I know you can't do it forever, but I really enjoyed coaching another sport, and then two when I first started, but another sport. And, you know, 23 years of soccer and being able to get over and coach a women's team, which I never would have done if I were in Division I basketball, you know, that's where I would have been locked in. And I had a chance to be a head coach of a women's soccer team and coach women. And it's a different ball of wax in some ways. In some ways, it's very much the same. But it was an experience that I wouldn't have been able to have at a higher level. And, you know, I think kids would stand for 4 years. We very seldom had kids leave our program. And that's relationships. That's teaching kids. I think what the one and done is done now, the one and done, more importantly, the transfer portal, is it's told kids, look, if you don't like your position, you know, leave and try to get the same position somewhere else. And I'm like, no, you just missed one of the big lessons that athletics teaches. And what athletics teaches is to persevere. Okay. And I'm not talking about an unreasonable situation, but I'm talking about in most situations, freshmen don't start. Freshmen very often don't play. And if you can't persevere through that and think that changing your space to another school is a solution, you've missed that great lesson of getting better. Because when you go out into the real world, okay, and you start out, you are the rookie. And if you turn around and think like, well, he's making more money than me, he's getting the plum assignment and I'm not, blah, 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 blah. So you decide to keep changing your companies. You've missed out on that point. And I think athletics teaches that the perseverance, you know, tie your shoes a little bit tighter and grit your teeth and get back in there and show the coach that you can play. Work at getting better so that you can play. And so there's just so many pieces that I think Division III, and most Division III, unless you've had a terrible, terrible, terrible situation, they're not higher and fire. In other words, you get a little more leeway. I've had some friends that have gone on to coach sort of in the mid-major level, and it's hell. I mean, yeah. It's hell. It's really, you know, always looking over your shoulder, because if you're not, you know, everybody thinks that their team should be the ones winning to get a bigger slice of the pie these days. It's all money driven. And I guess if you're getting paid that much money, then I guess you have to win, but not everybody can win. And so Division III was just, and I think I coached in the Camelot years, quite frankly. I think I coached back in the era when parents, I think I probably had two or three parents in 42 years complain to me about their son's playing time, which is so unusual. But you know, it was just, it was a great era to coach in, you know, there wasn't a dean specifically assigned, you know, for anonymous bias reporting, you know, whatever that means. And, so anyway, it was wonderful to coach during that era. And I think so much of that had to do with the fact that it was Division III, and so much that had, you know, to do with the fact that it was a school. And I say a school like Amherst versus just Amherst, because there are really some wonderful small colleges out there. And Amherst is somewhat unique, but not totally unique to that whole scene.
Yeah, the balance, I think, in 3-on-3 and or in Division III. And then I think when you talk about the transfer portal, it's one of those situations where I love what you talked about when you're talking about perseverance, and how I think so often, and unfortunately, we see this starting to permeate the game at even lower levels when you start talking about high school or AAU basketball, and people looking at their situation and just, hey, I'm going to jump to this place or this place or this place, always looking for something better. And I mean, you can look at the portal this year and the number of kids that went into the portal that unfortunately are still in the portal and may never find another home to be able to continue with their college basketball career. And I think that it's a great lesson. And the one that you shared is one that I learned when I played back. So I played from 88 to 92 at Kent State in my freshman year. I came in and we had a really good team, and I maybe played 5 minutes a game, maybe. And then the next year I looked and kind of figured out, okay, what is my coaching staff like? What do they want? What does this team need? And I figured it out and I worked. And, you know, then my next 3 years, I got to start and played a lot and played a ton of minutes. And I'm not sure that if I grew up in the era today, that after that first year, that there wouldn't have been multiple people in my ear saying, hey, you should go somewhere else. You're too good to be sitting on the bench, or whatever it might be, the messages that kids get. And I think you make a great point that, you know, in an ideal world, you know, you'd have kids that would come in and build, and by the time they're juniors and seniors, they're ready to play and contribute and be important members of the team. And I think that's the way that, again, in the era that you're talking about, that's oftentimes how you built teams, both at the Division III level, mid-major level, and now that it's really hard to do that, right? Because you develop a kid, like you said, in a year or two at Division III, and that kid becomes a really good player. And wow, all of a sudden it's a lot easier for them to go and get an offer somewhere else. And I think the same thing for mid-majors, where used to be you succeed at a mid-major by bringing in kids who kind of under the radar, or maybe you're able to develop a kid within your program. And now you do that, and after a year or two, somebody else is going to swoop in and be like, hey, we can take this kid and have him playing at a higher level, or just give him a different opportunity, whatever it might be. And yeah, it's kind of a wild west out there. I think it's going to settle down eventually, but man, it's crazy out there right now.
Yeah. And I think the NCAA, I think, has capped it as only two transfers now. And, you know, there was a kid that played New England this year, very good player, that and was on his third team. And so, you know, capping it a little bit, that takes some of it away. But you know, the other thing that we did when you develop a program, as opposed to just a team, you know, a program, you have senior parents, junior parents, sophomore parents sitting in the stands with freshman parents, and the freshman parents uneasy with their kids playing time. And all of a sudden a senior parent will put their arm around that parent, the freshman parent, and say, hey, be patient. Trust me. It's a good thing. You know, this is good for your son. And I know it's hard right now. It was hard for me when I was a freshman parent. But let me tell you something. 4 years later, I could tell you this is the best thing your son will ever do. And so, you know, we had a whole team. We had a whole program of people supporting each other and helping each other through these things. And, you know, I'm not sure that everybody has that. And so, again, just one of the great things that we built at Amherst that really made things work well for us.
And that doesn't happen by accident, Dave. I mean, I think obviously there are programs around the country, both at the high school and the college level, that do what you just described. But I'm not sure it's all that commonplace, because, again, it takes everybody pulling in the same direction. It takes a ton of communication between the coaching staff and the parents and the players. And it takes, especially on the college level, right, getting the right guys in the door and your recruiting and all the things that go into making that happen. And then you've got to continue to sustain it, because as we all know, you can build a culture or build that program, and if you kind of take your eyes off the prize for a year or two, it can go south really, really quickly. So the fact that you were able to have the success that you had for a sustained period of time for over 42 years is a testament to what you were able to do in terms of building a program. So obviously you're coaching for a long time, 42 years. What's the biggest change that you saw in the game from the time you started coaching until, I mean, there's probably 100 things, but maybe pick out one or two things that you feel really impacted the way that you had to coach the game.
Yeah. So I think that the 3-point shot really changed things up. And I'm proud to say that we, although we didn't embrace it to the level it's embraced today, where, you know, 50% of your shots are threes, we embraced it early. And so we had some really good shooters. We set up specific situations to get people 3-point shots. And so that was a fun time. Whenever things changed like that, when, you know, everybody was running four corners when there was no shot clock. And then there was a 40-second shot clock, which there might as well not, a 45-second, I think it was. There might not, you didn't need one anyway. 45 seconds is forever. So people were holding the ball. I remember going to scout a game that was 2-0 at halftime because the underdog team just held the ball. And I went to scout it and I got nothing. You know, I'm thinking I just drove my rear, you know, an hour and a half to see this game. And they're not even running anything. They're just holding the ball. Right. So, you know, the shot clock change. And now I think 30 is a great amount of time, but the 3-point shot was a big deal. And then I'll say this too. The other thing that people weren't doing back then, and again, because there were so many Bobby Knight disciples, that, you know, switching was a negative word. Switching meant that you didn't have the courage or the toughness or the physicality to get through a screen. And it was deemed that if you were looking to switch, that was a weakness. And, you know, certainly Coach Knight wasn't going to have any weaknesses. And so everybody toughed it out. And, you know, good screens are hard to get through. And, you know, you could do all sorts of things to try to disguise what's happening. But we started to switch. And I'll never forget, it was against Colby College. We had just made the NCAAs. First time in the history of the college that we could do it, in the history of our league that we could do it. And they ran, Dick Whitmore was a wonderful coach up at Colby and won a ton of games. And he had this, he ran one of the first like motion offenses where they brought three guys together at the elbow and you didn't know who was going to the basket, who was popping out, who was fading out to the wing. And really hard to guard. And so we just said, hey, look, you take the guy that comes up top, you take the guy that goes out to the wing, you take the guy that goes to the basket. And that was the beginning of us switching. And then next year and the next year we went more so to switching. And Matt Goldsmith, we've talked about him a couple times, but his group, you know, somebody get put in the game and go, hey, guys, 3-2. That meant we were going to switch the three little guys and the two big guys only. And then we might go 4-1. And then at the end of games, we're always switch 5. So we didn't give up 3-point shots, depending on what the situation was. And so I'm watching because we're winning a bunch of games. We're getting into the NCAAs and nobody else is switching. You know, I'm looking and I'm thinking like, guys, aren't you seeing what we are doing?
Right.
And I started to think like, well, maybe it's not as good as we're getting results, but maybe it's not as good as I think it is. Right. And now as you look, and I'm not saying we invented it by any means. I'm just saying that in New England, we were one of the few teams and maybe the only team that early on, so that's 94, that switched either 3, 4, or 5. And, you know, again, switching is a sign of weakness if you don't do it right. If you do it right, it's hard to do, but boy, it makes it hard for people to get open. And, you know, it really helped us. And so I would say that 3-point shot, the shot clock, and us switching on defense were the biggest changes that I saw certainly in our program over the years.
Yeah, I think the switching thing is super interesting. Again, going back to my own experiences as a player and early years as a coach, like, I mean, playing college basketball, I remember switching being, again, you just didn't do it. It was, hey, you got to get through this screen. You got to fight through. You got to be in position to skinny up, or you got to fight through, or you got to knock, or whatever it was, you had to figure out a way as a defender to get through that screen. And if you tried to switch, boy, that was cause for concern. And so
that's right.
I mean, it's just, again, a totally different thing. And then when you evolve, and then later on when I was a high school assistant coach, when you got to the point where switching became more normal, so to speak, and you're looking at it from a coaching perspective and you're like, it's so much easier. Like, it just, again, to your point, you have to do it well, but you just think about, again, it's more mentally taxing, right? You have to be aware of what's going on. You have to have guys with spatial awareness and basketball IQ and all those kinds of things. But from a physical, like getting beat up, trying to get through screens, I mean, that's been a huge change in the game. And then the other one that I think has changed a lot, and I say this to coaches a lot, you know, all the time. I played 4 years of college basketball, and I might have defended and been involved in 5 ball screens my entire career. And now you look at the way the game is played today and the number of ball screens that are set and the amount of time that coaches spend on ball screen coverages and how we're going to do it depending upon what the players in the screen and roll are capable of doing. It's just, it's amazing to me watching the game. Like, in some ways, it's unrecognizable to me, the game that, at least not necessarily the one I've coached in, but certainly the game that I played in is unrecognizable compared to what it's like today. It's just interesting how the game's evolved.
Yeah. And I do think that, you know, so much of it, you know, to do all those things well, whether it's switching that you're talking about, it takes a lot of practice and a lot of teaching. Like you say, spatial awareness, like understanding that you have to get underneath to get over. And the whole thing is, you know, I think to ball screens, and, you know, ball screens are the hardest thing. I mean, Stockton and Malone. And, you know, they made it the thing. But it took people, again, a long time to get to the point where we are today, which everything is a ball screen. And, you know, if you have one coverage, you know, I just don't know with the ability of players today, if you cover it one way, I just think they're going to figure it out and get the rhythm of it. And it's sort of like everything else, you know, if you change up and, you know, sometimes you're hedging hard, sometimes you're flat hedging, sometimes you're switching, whatever it is. It just throws the offensive people out of rhythm enough. Even if you have a little mismatch at times, it throws them out of the rhythm they were getting into if you cover it the same way. And so I just think, again, it takes smart players to understand, hey, guys, we're in blue coverage on ball screens, right? Whatever you want to call that, whether it's the hard edge or whatever. Hey, guys, we got red. Red's usually the hard edge, right? Because red is the emergency color, right? So anyway, you know, people that use colors, use numbers, you know, we talked about switching 2, switching 3, switching 4, switching 5. You got to have smart players to do that. And, you know, so, and it takes a lot of practice. And people that think that it doesn't, probably haven't won all that many games unless they have more talent than everybody, because I got to tell you, the amount of time that we spent prior to our Amherst Williams game when Mike Maker was there and he had a lot of these fade screens, this screen, that screen. We went over all of that stuff, and hopefully we had 2 or 3 days to you know, sort of brush up on our coverages of how we're going to cover that, because it's just different. And so there's a lot of preparation involved in making your team really good.
Yeah, there is. There's no question about that. I think that it's just like anything, right? Sometimes people see the product, whether it's a basketball team or it's an artist or it's a musician or it's a teacher or whatever. You see that final product and you're like, wow, you make that look pretty easy. And you don't always see what goes on behind the scenes in order to make that happen. I think sometimes that's the genius of genius, right? Is that it's all the work right behind it. It's not just what you see out for public consumption.
Right. And I have to tell you, so maybe one of the greatest compliments I've gotten in the game, we won the 2013 championship down in Atlanta, and John Feinstein, the famous author, came up to me and said, hey, can I talk to you for a while? So we sat down and talked, and he said, you know, something about your team that you need to tell me. He said, you know, I'd watch your guys come down and you know, guy call one or call fist, and yet you didn't run one or fist. And I said, well, actually we did. We just ran different versions of it. And he said, yeah, but how did you guys know what versions to run? And I'd say, well, because they read each other. And so that team, and the other, I've had other teams close to it, but that team probably hit the peak as far as being able to read each other, and things just morphed off what one other player did to make the choice of what this player did, you know, the key. And so, but the fact that Feinstein would ask me that question, and just me talking to Feinstein I was like blown away. But the fact that he would ask me that question and give me the chance to answer it so proudly as to what our team had evolved into that year. This group of people who just, you know, read each other, it's virtually undefendable because they don't know what you're going to run. And those are the teams that go on to be really successful and win championships.
And that's kind of the way that coaching has evolved too, again, right? Where you start talking about there's so many more coaches that are coaching in practice that way, trying to get their teams to play more free flowing and more read and react to what's going on, as opposed to you go back to the beginning of your career when you're talking about the Bobby Knight style, where maybe, yeah, you had the motion offense where there's a lot of off ball screens and that kind of thing, or you had coaches that were just running set after set after set where there really wasn't options. It was just, this is what you're going to do, and we're going to practice this and beat it into the ground, and we're just going to try to out execute you. Whereas today you have much more, again, players that have to, they have options. So you have multiple options, and you got to read your teammates. You got to read what the defense is doing. And so it makes you a lot harder to defend and scout and all the things that go into being prepared for a game. Another way that the game has evolved for sure.
Right. And I'll tell you just a quick story. I know we're running out of time, but so a good friend of mine who coached at a mid-major place, I'm not going to tell you any names, but he basically would say to me after his practices, he'd say, look, I have a choice. He said, I can either get people who are athletic enough to play at this level with lesser basketball IQ, or I can get people with high basketball IQ, but athletically they're not quite good enough to play at this level. And so if they were good enough athletically and basketball IQ, they would be at the highest level. And so we're right in no man's land to where I've got to make a decision. And if I choose better athletes, I sit there and I just, like, every day after practice, I'm like, I can't get through to these guys about reading.
Right.
And so anyway, it's that's one of the things about that level, which is tough.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Give me one story from one of your two national championship teams. Pick out your favorite story from either. I don't want you to shortchange one of the teams. So if you want to give me two stories, that's great. But just give me a story from each national championship team.
Well, and so I'll just give you this one because it's my favorite one. So 2013, we start out 5-0, and then we lose to Springfield team, which was good on the road. They were good, but we didn't play well. And then we came back and we just really laid an egg against a Babson team. And Stevie Brennan at Babson does a great job, but he was undermanned. I think they had 6 healthy kids or something like that, and they weren't all their starters, and we were not good. And so we go to 5-2. And I know there's something up, and I'm trying to figure it out, as coaches do. There's just a little something, right? And we do a lot of stuff to try to figure out what that stuff is from the get-go. But anyway, I had all 3 captains in my office, and I'm sort of pushing and poking to try to get them to talk and the whole thing. And our big kids, Pete Cathilla, who was 6'8", 265, and a wonderful specimen, a good player, never said a word, of course. And so I'm sitting there and I'm pushing and prying, and then out of the blue, Big Pete just, like, goes at it, just lets it all out. Just like, you know, you're pushing on a pimple and it finally pops or something. It was volcanic. And Pete goes, you guys are so selfish. You guys, all you do is care about your stats, and all you want to do is be first team all NESCAC. You're not interested in playing as a team and winning. And they get arguing, and it was great. I'm almost applauding on the side because I'm thinking, like, this is the poison we needed to get out. You know, people aren't talking to each other. You're never going to have a great team if they don't get it with each other. And so when we got done, and I thought there was going to be a fist fight, and I don't know what I would have done because Pete would have cleaned us all out. But anyway, there was one of the captains said, Coach, before practice, can we go down and talk to the team? Now, we had to play a really good Brandeis team the next day, and then we had to play somebody else really good on the Saturday. And so we had back-to-back games coming up, and they said, can we go down and talk, have a team meeting? I said, absolutely. And so they went down, they said what they had to say to the team. We came out, we had a great practice. We blew out Brandeis the next day. We won our next game. We didn't lose again for another full calendar year. And so I always tell people about that, is that, you know, as a leader, when you're seeing something, but you're not quite sure what it is, you got to find out what it is in order to be able to address it. And having that session in my office, and again, me being skilled enough and further along in my career where I could, rather than just say, look, guys, you're going to do this, you're going to do this, you're going to do this, you need to find out what it is. And so, you know, I was pushing and poking and prodding until finally Pete erupted. And it was probably, it probably redirected our program to, again, like I say, we didn't lose again for another whole year.
It's amazing how sometimes that stuff that's bubbling just under the surface, when you let it out, that it can just open the floodgates and make sure that everybody gets back on the same page and everybody's pulling that rope in the same direction. And that takes, as a coach, that takes having the pulse of your team, right? I think that's one of the things that I've learned both as a coach and thinking back to my time as a player and working with my own kids and that kind of thing. And you look at it and you say that, man, when coaches are dialed in and they have an understanding of their players and they're looking at the dynamics and they're not just watching the basketball, but they're watching the people too, then that's when you really can put something together magical.
Well, you know, and I think this, and I learned this along the way, and I actually got the original statement from a football coach. I was reading or hearing a podcast or doing something, and I think I was reading because it was that far back, to where this coach, he called it weeding. And every day, like if you have a garden and you go out and weed every day, you know, then you're going to keep your garden good. If you don't weed for 2 weeks, your garden's overgrown, and then you got to take the whole garden out and so, yeah. And start all over again. And so I would do that. I would get down to practice for 45 minutes early. And when I get down there 45 minutes early, you know, very often kids that are having problems would get down there early, get a chance to talk to them about their family, their schoolwork, but you'd also find out, you know, just what's going on. And I thought to myself, geez, this is really negative that we're just weeding. How about, and I'm down at Home Depot and I see weed and feed. And I thought, well, some kids, they don't need the weeding, they need the feeding. And so we changed that to weed and feed. And that has really helped us. We get down there, we try to figure out what kid needs what, how do we get it going, find out underlying problems. And that has really worked well for us over the years.
All right, Dave, final question. As experienced of a guy as you are, somebody who's just starting out in the coaching profession, it's their first day on the job, and they call you up and they say, hey, coach, give me one piece of advice that's going to help me to be successful in my career. What's that one piece of advice that you'd give them?
Well, I'll give you one piece of advice. And well, I would say it comes down to work, you know, outwork everybody. But underneath, it's not one piece, because underneath work is, you know, get out there and seek older coaches who have been through things. Doesn't mean you need to do what they do, because Hubie Brown once said, take only what you could teach. And I believe strongly in that. But listen to everybody. Take things, bring things in, sort it out, and fit it to your program. But all of that takes like so much work. It really does. But if you have a passion for it, it's not really work. And, you know, weed and feed every day in your program so you can figure out where you're going, what the kids are thinking, because you can't just be autocratic on everything. You got to like, you got to hear the vibes. And so, but again, that takes time. And so it really is, it becomes your family. And, you know, you need to really understand it and work at it. And, so I think hard work and passion are the two things, the two words that I would give you, that there's tentacles out underneath all of them. But those are the two things that, that get the ball rolling.
Absolutely. Great pieces of advice. Before we get out, Dave, I want to give you a chance to share, how can people connect with you? Is there a way for people to reach out to you, have listened to the podcast, heard your story? How can some young coaches reach out to you?
They're always welcome to email is the best way. And then if I can't, you know, do things by email, then, you know, I very often I've developed a relationship with a bunch of coaches and I watch their games during the year. I don't have time to do all of that. Of course, I'm watching a lot of NESCAC and Division III games, but, you know, if they send it to my email, which is ddhickson@amherst.edu, I'll get back to all of them. And, but you know, and it goes from there, you know, do we have a phone call? Do we, you know, whatever it is that we're doing. And so I do that when I do clinics, I do that when I do podcasts, and they're more than welcome to reach out to me that way.
Dave, cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule, especially after the whirlwind couple of weeks you've had with the Hall of Fame. So thank you for your time. Truly appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the portfolio guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your coaching portfolio guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.